Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, honoring the national origin of our host, Professor Samantha Besson, I suggest we start on time. So, welcome to this afternoon panel. After this morning panel, my name is Pierre Dargent. I'm a professor at Louvain University. Very happy to be here and to meet with all of you. After this morning panel dedicated to notions, types, and roles of consent, we turn to objects of consent. And we have four distinguished panelists. First, we'll hear Professor Duncan Hollis from Temple Law School is seated at my left. Well, everybody is seated at my left. It will be for Professor Fouad Zarbieh from the Institut des Hautes Études Internationales et du Développement de Genève to take the floor. Then we'll have a break, and then we have Professor Jutta Brunet from the University of Toronto Law School and Professor Boisson Chazourne from the University of Geneva. Like this morning, I think none of our speakers need an introduction. We have two men and two women speaking in turn with a break in between, and then I will take back the floor to do some comments, and then, as this morning, the floor will be also to you to address your questions to the panelists. So, Duncan, the floor is yours. Without any further ado, thank you very much.
Well, let me begin by first, of course, saying thanks to Professor Besson for putting this amazing group together and giving us an opportunity to talk about consent in such diverse ways. I think for all the questions about consent in international law broadly, when it comes to the law of treaties, I think, let me see if I get this. The role of consent remains unbowed. Consent may not be the basis for the treaty obligation. That honor, of course, goes to pacta sunt servanda. But consent does function as the evidentiary vehicle by which pacta sunt servanda assigns treaties their binding force. And as every student of international law learns, right, states create their treaties via consent, while treaties only bind consenting states. I think less well recognized is the way consent serves other functions beyond treaty making. And what I hope to do with my contribution here in the chapter that I hope that this project produces is to kind of think about how we could group these other functions. And I have tried here a typology of thinking about consent into three camps: consent as commitment, content, and constitution. I think, first of all, consent establishes the social fact of a commitment, right? And it constructs all international agreements, not just those governed by international law, treaties, but also those governed by national law, contracts, and even those that are not governed by law at all, which I use the term political commitments for. At the same time, consent also, and here Jean and I may disagree, right? I think consent elucidates the agreement's content, right? It discerns not just whether there is an agreement, but what's in it. And finally, I think consent can constitute the rules for agreement making. To use the language of HLA Hart, we can think of consent delimiting not only primary rules, but also secondary rules, right? Determining who can make treaties, how they do so, and how they are recognized, adjusted, or ended. So I think in some ways, then, the consent in the context of international agreements is ubiquitous. And so I think what I want to do here with you today is kind of to foreground consent's multitude of functions. And doing so, I think, raises two questions for us. One, what are the elements that comprise consent? And two, again, kind of following my Hartian model here, what are the rules of recognition in international agreements when it comes to identifying consent? And here, at least from my own perspective, I don't think either international law or international relations is terribly well equipped to answer such inquiries. I think consent remains an underexamined and polysemous concept, right? It oscillates between elements that are subjective, right? Thinking about consent as a manifestation of will and objective, right? Consent is that idea I think we heard about this morning as the acceptance of some thing. And obviously that leaves ample room for diverging views on consent's presence or absence in individual circumstances. At the same time, I think consent is largely, what I would say, undifferentiated, right? To be sure, some formalities will help us recognize consent's purpose, right? An instrument of ratification will almost always embody a state's consent to be bound. But overall, however, international law does not mandate any formalities for consent's particular functions, nor any methodologies for identifying it in their absence. So I think, kind of simply put, almost any of consent's functions can be established by almost any means, formal or informal. And I guess from my perspective, as I kind of worked through this, I wanted to ask, or at least pose the question, is this ubiquity, this polysemy, is this ambiguity, is it problematic? So for example, if any measure of consent can establish the existence of a treaty commitment, how do we know when consent establishes the existence of a political commitment instead? And I think that the challenge, at least as I see here, is that we're going to have trouble recognizing consent, and in doing so, we open the door to both theoretical disputes, but also the reality of disputes, disagreements, and confusion among states and other stakeholders in the international community. And I think those disputes are not just about the existence of international agreements, but again, about their contents and about those relevant constitutive rules. And I think in some ways, consent's polysemy may even create perverse incentives, right, to label as consent constructions where, in fact, consent is absent, right? That it is the assignment by a binding third-party dispute body or otherwise that, you know, we move from consent in fact to consent in law. So I guess the question is, how can international law address these consent problems? And there are various candidates that are not terribly, sorry about the alignment there, that are out there already. So one, we might reconceptualize how we think about these different forms of international agreement. We might use presumptions or defaults. We might use content-based criteria. And I think for my part, I wanted to make a modest additional suggestion, invoking the architect Louis Sullivan's famous maxim that form ever follows function. I want to at least inquire about the possibility of more formalization, right? Could we have international law mandate different formalities to serve consent's different functions? At least from a first glance, doing so might improve consent's efficacy, right? It could create new pathways in doing so to improve the efficacy of international agreements themselves. So in my remaining time, I kind of want to unpack this idea of this multitude of functions that I see consent serving just in the international agreements space, talk about consent as commitment, as content, as constitution, or more accurately, constitutive rules, and then outline some of the problems I think that follow from the ubiquity we see out there right now, and then talk a little bit more about whether this suggests at least a new research agenda, beyond even the one that we are engaging with these 2 days. Okay, consent as commitment. So here I think we begin on the common ground, right, which is a treaty will not bind states without their consent, right? States must consent to be legally bound to a treaty. I think that's pretty uncontroversial. Of course, a state won't bind a treaty by consent alone, right? Like all agreements, treaties require not just the commitment that consent represents, but also some mutuality, some people, the collectivity, if you will, right? Two or more states making commitments that are overlapping, as it were. So consent, in this sense, is a required but not sufficient condition to trigger that principle, pacta sunt servanda. Here, though, I would note that consent's role when it comes to commitments is not limited to consent to be bound, right? So if you look across just the law of treaties, right, we see that consent can be the basis for a treaty's adoption. It can be the basis for a treaty's authentication. It is consent that dictates third-party rights and obligations, right? The consent of both the treaty parties to opening the door to such third-party rights and obligations, and of course, the consent of the third party to such an arrangement. And of course, just as consent can create the commitment or participate in the agreement's creation, right? It can also contribute to its end, right? That, you know, the mutuality of consent can end a treaty via treaty termination. You know, we talked already this morning about like the EU, intra-EU bit treaty termination exercise where member states are trying to end those treaty relationships mutually. At the same time, as I think I alluded at the outset, consent's role is not limited to just constructing treaty commitments. The reality is that consent is a prerequisite for any agreement. I mean, most obviously, of course, consent is an essential element for agreements governed by national law, contracts. But it is equally essential to the formation of agreements that are denied or are intended to be denied any legal force, that are, you know, built on political or moral bases exclusively, right? And that is, you know, again, this concept of political commitments. And I think the issue, of course, with political commitments is they've been around for a century or more, but we're seeing an increasingly rising use in the last several decades, and especially in the last decade, so much so that it's become a matter on the agenda of international organizations. I did some work with the OAS, CADI, the Council of Europe's legal advisors took up the topic. And so we're seeing more and more attention to the way political commitments are being utilized and constructed. Of course, as I said, there are no mandatory formalities or methodologies for establishing the existence of a political commitment or differentiating what it is doing in any particular case. So I think that's, you know, raises the potential. The more political commitments we see being created by consent, the more challenges we'll see for how do we differentiate it from, say, the consent to commit to a treaty in contrast. Now, of course, the law of treaties does offer some guideposts for identifying the existence of consent to be bound. The VCLT lists 5 vehicles for doing so, you know, definitive signature, ratification, etc. But none of these are actually required, as Article 11 of the VCLT suggests, that parties can indicate their consent to be bound by, quote, any other means, if so agreed. And that has left, I think, quite a room for creativity and creative methods for states to express their consent to be bound. So we've seen, consent to be bound by the completion of the domestic procedures themselves, by initialing, by the production of collateral documents, like in the Algiers Accords by the US and the Iran without actually there ever being in the same room, by the adoption of resolutions, to say nothing of the Vienna Convention's acknowledgement of the potential for oral treaties, which presumably would incorporate oral consent. International tribunals have, I think, endorsed this flexibility. So we've seen the ICJ find state consent to an agreement in agreed minutes in the Qatar-Bahrain case, in an understanding in pulp mills, and via declarations in the case involving Cameroon and Nigeria. To quote Jan Clobbers, right, states have, he says, unlimited freedom as far as the methods of expressing consent to be bound are concerned. And that same freedom, I think, pervades other forms of consent as commitment. There is no act contraire doctrine requiring states to use the same form of consent, for example, to terminate a treaty as to its creation. And I do think that that poses at least conceptually a potential problem, right? Because if anything can denote consent to a treaty or to the end of a treaty, how can consent denote other forms of international agreement? Now here, I think national laws will help us work through these issues on contracts, right? We've seen the national legislation has delineated certain markers, but political commitments have no such directives. And so I think it, you know, we see the potential for how are we going to differentiate cases where we have consent and we're not sure what it is. Now maybe when you have a ratification or an acceptance or approval, that won't be terribly problematic. But signature, I think, when an agreement is, you know, the consent is manifested by signature, there, and I think we have the problem of we don't know what it is. Is it definitive signature? That is consent to be bound? Is it simple signature? As a prelude to ratification? Or is it consent to the terms of a political commitment? Now, sometimes the parties will mutually agree on consent's function. So in the Iron Rhine arbitration, Belgium and the Netherlands acknowledged that they had consented to an agreement in their memorandum of understanding, and they also agreed that that memorandum of understanding was not a binding instrument. You know, in other cases, like pulp mills, however, we do see that parties differ on what their consent did, right? And there the argument was, you know, neither Argentina nor Uruguay could agree that their presidents had consented to an agreement via a press release in 2005. They were differentiating about whether that agreement was a binding treaty or not. So they agreed they had an agreement, but they hadn't kind of elaborated what that consent to that agreement entailed. I think, you know, what we've seen in the practice is kind of primarily a bifurcation of approaches. Into a subjective test and an objective test. And I think each of these trace back to that kind of polysemy of the consent concept itself. So, you know, on the one hand, the International Law Commission, the negotiators at the Vienna Conference, a number of states and several international tribunals like the South China Seas Tribunal have endorsed differentiating consent to, say, treaties from political commitments based on party intentions, right? It is a search for intentions that will necessarily, you know, determine, is it a treaty or is it a political commitment? And in that sense, we're seeing consent as a manifestation of the party's will, which is why I asked Professor Pillay, you know, at the end of our morning session, you know, whether that his conception of consent could encompass a manifestation of will. But the idea here is we're focusing on what did the parties understand their consent to do and assessing the extent of any intersubjectivity that results. I think in contrast, the court, the ICJ, and a number of other states have emphasized a more objective approach, right? And there we're using the object of the party's consent, right, to kind of catalog its legal or non-legal status, right? So in Qatar v. Bahrain, right, the court found the parties had concluded a legally binding agreement to accept the ICJ's jurisdiction in the form of those agreed minutes, notwithstanding the kind of the infamous protestations of the Bahrain foreign minister that was not what he had intended the consent to the agreed minutes to do. There, the court focused on, quote, the terms of the instrument itself and the circumstances of its conclusion, not from what the parties say afterwards was their intention. So in this sense, under this kind of objective approach, right, the party's consent to a treaty is kind of derived from the markers, the language and the types of clauses that are included in the instrument, which suggests that the character of an agreement can be inferred from its object, right, in lieu of deducing it from some search for parties' manifestation of will. Now, I should be clear, obviously, the intent and objective tests are not the only way we might make these differentiations. You could look to the surrounding circumstances, right? So, you know, the use of domestic legislative approval procedures might be a marker to push our consent in one direction or another. We can look at the subsequent practice of the agreement makers, as the South China Seas case, right, said, well, to the extent China had described the agreements in question as political documents, the court was going to give them that status, whatever other indicators might have been, including using the word agree or what have you in the text. So I think, you know, we can also, I think, you know, be concerned nonetheless, right, that with the rising use of political commitments, I think we're going to see more disputes will occur about what the type of consent participants intend or objectively made when they reach agreements. And, you know, given so much doubt, I think, you know, we then have to ask, well, what about, you know, can we get to consent through passive means, right? Can these ever comprise the requisite consent? Reuter obviously had his doubts, as did Brierley. Nico Kriesch, I think, in his article on non-consensual lawmaking, differentiates, for example, consent from consensus, suggesting the contribution of acquiescence to consensus differentiates it from the more kind of active manifestations of will that he identified as being consent. And I do agree. I think, you know, acquiescence has traditionally been excluded from situations calling for affirmative consent, right? Like agreement formation, right? Acquiescence is usually, you know, your failure to object when circumstances called for you to object. But here I'd note Professor Besson's, I think, astute observation in this field that, you know, consent necessarily involves an agreement to disagree, suggesting in some ways that even consent itself will incorporate non-consensual or non-consent-based elements. And if that's the case, then I think the delta between consent and consensus in some ways may narrow or may not be so great. Now, of course, I think that's different than when you have the kind of new forms of consensus where you're seeing it reached over the overt objections of a participant, as we've seen in some multilateral environmental contexts. I think the other thing, frankly, is you've seen the ICJ and ITLOS identify the possibility of tacit agreements without explaining whether and how states consented to them, other than putting in an evidentiary hurdle, right? Saying that the evidence of a tacit agreement must be, I think it's compelling, quote unquote, compelling evidence. And I do think the concepts of passive and tacit consent again beg that question of whether consent in such cases is arising in fact, or is it really just by operation of law, where we have decision makers, adjudicators, articulating what they think consent should have been forthcoming in a particular circumstance, rather than it did in fact occur. Now, I think for all the complexity around consent as commitment, I want to make it clear that this is not all that consent does, right? It's not just consent to construct a treaty or other forms of international agreement. Consent to an agreement does more than elaborate the fact of a commitment, right? It also elaborates or determines, at least as a first pass, its contents, right? So, for example, two states conclude a bilateral extradition treaty, right? There, their consent not only contributes to the formation of the treaty, but also delineates its contents, right? The substantive rights or obligations expected of each state party. I think similarly, consent to a political commitment does the very same thing. It not only establishes the existence of an agreement, but tells us what the political expectations are that are set. So I think the questions of, when we think about questions of what an agreement means or how it applies, whether temporally or spatially, you know, in some ways they all end up being tied to the nature and the scope of the consent offered to join the agreement itself. And so, I would note, of course, in doing so, all the difficulties I just described in identifying and differentiating forms of consent as commitment necessarily extend into any process of using consent for content determination. If, unlike Professor Despremont, you think that's possible, or maybe not. I think, at the same time, consent's contributions to content aren't bounded by the original commitment, right? Consent can manifest content in other ways. So reservations allow a party to unilaterally condition its consent to be bound, right? Changing the content of its commitments by excluding or modifying treaty provisions that the reserving state would otherwise have assumed. Of course, the admissibility of reservations is in some ways a function of consent, whether directly, based on whether the treaty permits reservations, allows them, or allows them in part. And indirectly, I think otherwise, by what was the object and purpose of the treaty in the first place. Consent, of course, also plays a dramatic role in the acceptance of reservations, right? By non-reserving states, right? Or its absence, where states reject the reservation and with it the application of the provisions to which the reservation relates, or in rarer cases, the treaty relationship as a whole. Consent can also construct treaty contents via the parties consenting after the fact to a subsequent interpretive agreement within the meaning of VCLT Article 30, Paragraph 3A. I mean, interestingly, right, the ILC has concluded that these subsequent agreements don't have to be treaties. They do not need to be binding. They can be binding or non-binding, suggesting that consent to a political commitment can assist in giving a treaty commitment meaning. Now, beyond reservations and interpretive agreements, consent is also critical to amendments. Right? As a general rule, amendments only bind consenting parties. Now, parties can consent in advance to less consensual amendment forms via the sorts of tacit consent procedures we often see in the context of multilateral environmental agreements, you know, the various opt-in or opt-out formulations. I would note, though, I at least would approach these non-consensual tools with some caution. Invite you, for example, to consider the kind of the most famous one of the most famous examples, the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer. Right, its text authorizes adjustments to the list of certain chemical control measures on a supermajority vote. Right, kind of suggesting a departure from mutuality of consent. But Yuda should correct me if I'm wrong, I still believe to this date that that procedure has never been used, that the parties have always chosen consensus in lieu of that procedure. And I think that raises a descriptive question for me, right? Which is, how often are non-consensual options that are available in principle actually being used by states and other stakeholders in practice, right? I do think in any case that, like consent as commitment, international law and international relations have done little to structure how states manifest consent as content, right? The formalities here are few and far between, right? Reservations arise by their purported effect, not the form employed. As I said earlier, subsequent agreements can be binding or non-binding. And as amendments, as Villager explained, you know, they don't even need to be in writing, that they could be done by tacit or even oral means. And I think that vagary poses additional challenges for us, right? You know, at what point does this anterior consent, right, become so attenuated from subsequent adjustments to a treaty's contents that it no longer warrants being deemed consent at all? And how do we differentiate consent to a subsequent agreement for interpretive purposes from consent to a treaty amendment? All right. Beyond these two functions, and I see I'm running close on time, so I'll move along, right? I just want to flag the constitutive rules, which I've already kind of alluded to throughout here, right? We're looking at both who can make treaties being a function of consent and what the rules are. So the reality is that in some ways, when states consent to a treaty, they are implicitly consenting to the treaty-making status of whoever their partner is, right? And it may be recognizing the other as a state as part of that consent, but we've also seen it with non-state actors, right? So that, you know, agreements with supranational actors, agreements with extranational actors, substate actors, and the like. So in some ways, then consent is constructing, you know, the secondary rules of who has the power to make international agreements. And of course, it's not just treaties. We see that consent to political commitments is also open now to multi-stakeholder communities. Being here in Paris, I should note, you know, as an example, President Macron's 2018 Paris call for trust and security in cyberspace that has over 1,000 signatories, including 60-something nation states, but also states like the Virginia and Colorado, firms, civil society, and even some academics. And of course, beyond the consent as constructing who can make treaties, we also, as I've alluded, it's the so many of the secondary rules about international agreements are themselves consensual or consent-based, right? So all the rules that I've talked about in terms of authentication, interpretive agreements, reservations, and the like are all kind of manifestations of consent in some way. And you know, even all the VCLT's rules on validity are tied, with the exception of jus cogens, to elucidating what is valid consent and what is not considered valid consent. And the question I would ask is, what about, you know, can consent even be a tertiary rule? Like, are parties able to override whatever the non-consent-based rules, for example, one finds in the Vienna Convention, whether it's, you know, retroactivity of treaties, or are things like the, you know, there's geographic application, as it were. And so how far down the road of consenting to consent do we go? Does it run all the way to pacta sunt servanda, or are there certain intermediate breakpoints where we say, you know, this is the limit of consent? So quickly, just in terms of redressing, I would just flag that the ones that are out there already are pretty well established. So you have Jan Klobbers kind of saying what we need to do is just define away political commitments so that anytime states are consenting to an agreement, they're consenting to a treaty. That doesn't help us differentiate treaties from contracts terribly well, doesn't help us differentiate, you know, interpretive agreements from reservations. Presumptions and defaults might hold more promise, right? Maybe we should just presume when we have consent among certain actors that it'll be a treaty. And we might vary those presumptions depending on who the actors are. So you might have one presumption among when it's states inter se versus another one when a state is doing an agreement with a non-state actor of some kind. Roberto Aggo, years ago at the ILC, said, hey, why don't we just decide that anytime you do an agreement on boundaries or territorial seas, it's a treaty, independent of questions of intent. And I think all of these are worth kind of exploring more. I would just flag, and I'll kind of wrap up here, that, you know, it's been a century since Lord McNair kind of said, hey, you know, treaties are like Swiss Army knives. They serve multiple purposes. Maybe we need different rules for different types of treaties. And why not think about mandating different formalities for different functions consent serves? Not just to distinguish treaties as consent to treaties versus consent to political commitments, but maybe, you know, consent as commitment versus consent as some form of content, as it were. So we kind of could differentiate consent working on law ascertainment from content determination, and figure out where the limits are on that regression as it goes to consent. So I see I've gone 1 minute over, breaking the panel's early morning panel success. So I'll just close here by throwing up the call for maybe, I'm trying to be quite modest. I really am just trying to explore whether this is a project worth further exploration, either descriptively or normatively. So thanks for your attention, and I apologize for taking that one extra minute. Thank you.